This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Someone We Know by Sherry LaPena. Read for you by Kirsten Potter. To Manuel. Prologue. Friday, September 29th. She's standing in the kitchen, looking out the large back windows. She turns toward me. There's a swing of thick brown hair, and I see the confusion and then the sudden fear in her wide brown eyes. She has registered the situation, the danger. Our eyes lock. She looks like a beautiful, frightened animal, but I don't care. I feel a rush of emotion, pure, uncontrolled rage. I don't feel any pity for her at all. We're both aware of the hammer in my hand. Time seems to slow down. It must be happening quickly, but it doesn't feel that way. Her mouth opens, about to form words, but I'm not interested in what she has to say. Or maybe she was going to scream. I lunge toward her. My arm moves fast, and the hammer connects hard with her forehead. There's a grisly sound and a shocking spurt of blood. Nothing comes out of her mouth but a gasp of air. She starts to drop, even as she raises her hands up toward me, as if she's pleading for mercy. Or maybe she's reaching for the hammer. She staggers, like a bull about to go down. I bring the hammer down again, this time on the top of her head, and there's extra force this time, because her head is lower. I have more momentum in my swing, and I want to finish her off. She's on her knees now, crumpling, and I can't see her face. She falls forward, face down, and lies still. I stand above her, breathing heavily, the hammer in my hand dripping blood onto the floor. I need to be sure she's dead, so I hit her a few more times. My arm is tired now, and my breathing labored. The hammer is covered in gore, and my clothes are streaked with blood. I reach down and turn her over. One eye is smashed. The other is still open. But there's no life in it. Monday, October 2nd. Aylesford, a city in New York's Hudson Valley, is a place of many charms. Chief among them, the historic downtown along the Hudson River and two majestic bridges that draw the eye. The Hudson Valley is renowned for its natural beauty, and across the river, an hour's drive on mostly good highways can get you deep into the Catskill Mountains, which are dotted with little towns. The Aylesford train station has ample parking and frequent trains into New York City. You can be in Manhattan in under 2 hours. In short, it's a congenial place to live. There are problems, of course, as there are anywhere. Robert Pierce enters the Aylesford police station, a new modern building of brick and glass, and approaches the front desk. The uniformed officer at the desk is typing something into a computer and glances at him, holding up a hand to indicate he'll just be a second. What would a normal husband say? Robert clears his throat. The officer looks up at him. Okay, just give me a minute. He finishes entering something into the computer while Robert waits. Finally, the officer turns to him. How can I help? He asks. I'd like to report a missing person. The officer now gives Robert his full attention. Who's missing? My wife. Amanda Pierce. Your name? Robert Pierce. When was the last time you saw your wife? Friday morning, when she left for work. He clears his throat again. She was going to leave directly from the office to go away with a girlfriend for the weekend. She left work as planned, but she didn't come back home last night. Now it's Monday morning, and she's still not home. The officer looks at him searchingly. Robert feels himself flush under the man's gaze. He knows how it looks, but he must not let that bother him. He needs to do this. He needs to report his wife missing. Have you tried calling her? Robert looks at him in disbelief. He wants to say, "Do you think I'm stupid?" But he doesn't. Instead, he says, sounding frustrated, Of course I've tried calling her numerous times, but her cell just goes to voicemail and she's not calling me back. She must have turned it off. What about the girlfriend? Well, that's why I'm worried, Robert admits. He pauses awkwardly. The officer waits for him to continue. I called her friend, Caroline Liu, and she says they didn't have plans this weekend. She doesn't know where Amanda is. There's a silence, and the officer says, I see. He looks at Robert warily, or as if he feels sorry for him. Robert doesn't like it. What did she take with her? The officer asks. A suitcase? Her passport? She was packed for the weekend, yes. She had an overnight case, and her purse. I don't know if she took her passport. He adds, she said she was going to park at the station and take the train into Manhattan for a shopping weekend with Caroline. But I went through the parking lot first thing this morning, and I didn't see her car there. I don't mean to be insensitive, the officer says, but are you sure she's not seeing someone else and lying to you about it? He adds gently, I mean, if she lied to you about going off with her friend, maybe she's not really missing. Robert says, I don't think she would do that. She would tell me. She wouldn't just leave me hanging. He knows he sounds stubborn. I want to report her missing, he insists. Were there problems at home? Was your marriage okay? The officer asks. It was fine. Any kids? No. All right, let me take down your particulars and a description, and we'll see what we can do, the officer says reluctantly. But honestly, it sounds like she left of her own accord. She'll probably turn up. People take off all the time. You'd be surprised. Robert looks at the officer coldly. Are you not even going to look for her? Can I have your address, please? Chapter 1. Saturday, October 14th. Olivia Sharp sits in her kitchen drinking a cup of coffee, gazing blankly out the glass sliding doors to the backyard. It's mid-October, and the maple tree near the back fence is looking splendid in its reds and oranges and yellows. The grass is still green, but the rest of the garden has been prepared for winter. It won't be long before the first frost, she thinks. But for now, she enjoys the yellow sunlight filtering through her backyard and slanting across her spotless kitchen. Or she tries to. It's hard to enjoy anything when she is coming to a slow boil inside. Her son, Raleigh, still isn't up. Yes, it's Saturday, and he's been in school all week, but it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and it drives her crazy that he's still asleep. She puts down her coffee and trudges once again up the carpeted stairs to the second floor. She hesitates outside her son's bedroom door, reminds herself not to yell, and then knocks lightly and opens it. As she expected, he's sound asleep. His blanket is still over his head. He pulled it over his head the last time she came in, a half hour ago. She knows he hates it when she tells him to get up, but he doesn't do it on his own, and what is she supposed to do, let him sleep all day? On the weekends, she likes to let him relax a little, but for Christ's sake, it's mid-afternoon. Raleigh, get up. It's after 2 o'clock. She hates the edge she hears in her voice, but she expends so much energy trying to get this boy out of bed every day, it's hard not to resent it. He doesn't so much as twitch. She stands there looking down at him, feeling a complicated mix of love and frustration. He's a good boy, a smart but unmotivated student, completely lovable. He's just lazy. Not only will he not get out of bed on his own, but he doesn't do his homework, and he doesn't help with chores around the house without endless nagging. He tells her he hates her nagging. Well, she hates it too. She tells him that if he did what she asked the first time, she wouldn't have to repeat herself, but he doesn't seem to get it. She puts it down to his being 16. 16-year-old boys are murder. She hopes that by the time he's 18 or 19, his prefrontal cortex will be more developed, and he will have better executive function and start being more responsible. Raleigh, come on, get up! He still doesn't move, doesn't acknowledge her existence, not even with a grunt. She sees his cell phone lying face up on his bedside table. If he won't get up, fine, she'll confiscate his cell phone. She imagines his hand flailing around, reaching for it before he even takes the covers off his head. She snatches the phone and leaves the room, slamming the door behind her. He'll be furious, but so is she. She returns to the kitchen and puts his phone down on the counter. It pings. A text message has popped up. She has never snooped in her son's phone or computer. She doesn't know his passwords. And she completely trusts him. But this message is right there in front of her. And she looks at it. "Did you break in last night?" She freezes. What the hell does that mean? Another ping. "Get anything good?" Her stomach flips. "Text me when you're up." She picks up the phone and stares at it, waiting for another message, but nothing comes. She tries to open his phone, but of course it's password protected. Her son was out last night. He said he'd gone to a movie with a friend. He didn't say who. She asks herself what she should do. Should she wait for his father to get back from the hardware store, or should she confront her son first? She feels terribly uneasy. Is it possible Raleigh could be up to no good? She can't believe it. He's lazy, but he's not the kind of kid to get into trouble. He's never been in any trouble before. He has a good home, a comfortable life, and two parents who love him. He can't possibly... If this is what it looks like, his father will be furious, too. Maybe she'd better talk to Raleigh first. She climbs the stairs, the earlier love and frustration shoved abruptly aside by an even more complicated mix of rage and fear. She barges into his room with his phone in her fist and yanks the covers off his head. He opens his eyes blearily. He looks angry, like a wakened bear, but she's angry too. She holds his cell phone in front of him. "What were you up to last night, Raleigh? And don't say you were at the movies because I'm not buying it. You'd better tell me everything before your father gets home." Her heart is pounding with anxiety. What has he done? Raleigh looks up at his mom. She's standing over him with his cell phone in her hand. What the hell is she doing with his cell phone? What is she blathering on about? He's annoyed, but he's still half asleep. He doesn't wake up just like that. It's an adjustment. "What?" he manages to say. He's pissed off at her for barging in here when he's asleep. She's always trying to wake him up. She always wants everyone on her schedule. Everyone knows his mom's a bit of a control freak. She should learn to chill. But now she looks really mad. She's glaring at him in a way he's never seen before. He suddenly wonders what time it is. He turns to look at his clock radio. It's 2:15. Big deal. Nobody died. "What the hell have you been up to?" she demands, holding his phone out like an accusation. His heart seems to skip a beat and he holds his breath. What does she know? Has she gotten into his phone? But then he remembers that she doesn't know the passcode, and he starts to breathe again. "I just happened to be glancing at your phone when a text came in," his mom says. Raleigh struggles to sit up, his mind going blank. Shit, what did she see? "Have a look," she says, and tosses the phone at him. He thumbs the phone and sees the damning texts from Mark. He sits there staring at them, wondering how to spin this. He's afraid to look his mother in the face. "Raleigh, look at me," she says. She always says that when she's mad. Slowly he looks up at her. He's wide awake now. "What do those texts mean?"
"What texts?" he says stupidly, playing for time, but he knows he's busted. The texts are pretty fucking clear. How could Mark be so stupid?
He looks back down at the phone again. It's easier than looking at his mother's face. "Did you break in last night? Get anything good?" He starts to panic. His brain can't come up with anything fast enough to satisfy his mother. All he can think of is a desperate...
"It's not what it looks like."
"Oh, that's good to hear," his mom says in her most sarcastic voice. "Because it looks like you've been up to a bit of breaking and entering." He sees an opening.
"It's not like that. I wasn't stealing."
She gives him an enraged look and says, "You'd better tell me everything, Raleigh. No bullshit." He knows he can't get out of this by denying it. He's caught like a rat in a trap, and now all he can do is damage control.
"I did sneak into somebody's house, but I wasn't stealing. It was more like just looking around," he mutters. "You actually broke into someone's house last night?" his mother says, aghast. "I can't believe this. Raleigh, what were you thinking?"
She throws her hands up.
Why on earth would you even do that?
He sits there on his bed, speechless, because he doesn't know how to explain. He does it because it's a kick, a thrill. He likes to get into other people's houses and hack into their computers. He doesn't dare tell her that. She should be glad he's not doing drugs.
Whose house was it? She demands now.
His mind seizes. He can't answer that. If he tells her whose house he was in last night, she'll completely lose it. He can't bear to think of what the consequences of that might be.
I don't know, he lies. Well, where was it?
I can't remember. What difference does it make? I didn't take anything. They won't even know I was there.
His mom leans her face in toward him and says, Oh, they'll know all right.
He looks at her in fear.
What do you mean?
You're going to get dressed, and then you're going to show me the house you broke into, and then you're going to knock on the door and apologize.
I can't,
he says desperately. You can and you will, she says, whether you want to or not. He starts to sweat.
Mom, I can't. Please don't make me.
She looks at him shrewdly. What else aren't you telling me? She asks. But at that moment, he hears the front door opening and his dad whistling as he drops his keys on the table in the hall. Raleigh's heart starts to pound, and he feels slightly sick. His mother he can handle, but his dad? He can't bear to think of how his dad's going to react. He didn't anticipate this. He never thought he'd get caught. Fucking Mark!
Get up, now, his mother commands, ripping the rest of the covers off him. We're going to talk to your father.
As he makes his way down the stairs in his pajamas, he's sweating. When they enter the kitchen, his dad looks up in surprise. He can obviously tell from their expressions that something's up. The whistling stops abruptly.
What's going on?
His dad asks.
Maybe we'd better all sit down,
his mother says, pulling out a chair at the kitchen table. Raleigh has something to tell you, and you're not going to like it. They all sit. The sound of the chairs scraping against the floor rips at Raleigh's raw nerves like nails on a chalkboard. He has to confess, he knows that. But he doesn't have to tell them everything. He's more awake now, better able to think.
Dad, I'm really sorry, and I know it was wrong,
he begins. His voice is trembling, and he thinks it's a good start. But his dad's brow has darkened already, and Raleigh's afraid. He hesitates. What the hell have you done, Raleigh? His father asks. He stares back at his dad, but the words don't come. For a moment, he feels completely paralyzed.
He broke into somebody's house, his mother says finally. What?
There's no mistaking the shock and fury in his father's voice. Raleigh quickly averts his eyes and looks at the floor. He says,
I didn't break in, I snuck in.
Why the hell did you do that? His father demands. Raleigh shrugs his shoulders but doesn't answer. He's still staring at the floor.
When?
His mother prods him with a hand on his shoulder. Raleigh? He finally raises his head and looks at his dad.
Last night?
His father looks back at him, his mouth hanging open.
You mean while we were here having friends over for dinner and you were supposed to be at a movie, you were actually out sneaking into someone else's house?
His voice has grown in volume until, by the end of the sentence, his father is shouting. For a moment, there's silence. The air vibrates with tension.
Were you alone, or were you with someone else?
Alone, he mumbles.
So we can't even console ourselves with the idea that someone else led you into this completely unacceptable criminal behavior.
Raleigh wants to put his hands over his ears to block out his dad's shouting, but he knows this will only incense his dad further. He knows it looks worse that he acted alone.
Whose house was it?
I don't know.
So what happened?
His dad glances at his mom and then back at him.
Did you get caught?
Raleigh shakes his head and his mom says,
No, I saw a text on his cell phone. Raleigh, show your dad the texts.
Raleigh unlocks and hands over the phone, and his dad looks at the screen in disbelief.
Jesus, Raleigh, how could you? Have you done this before?
This is the thing about his father. He knows what questions to ask. Things his mother, rattled by shock, didn't think to ask. Raleigh has done it before, a few times.
Just one other time,
He lies, avoiding his father's eyes. So you've broken into two houses? He nods. Does anyone know? Raleigh shakes his head. Of course not.
Of course not,
his dad repeats sarcastically. His dad's sarcasm is worse than his mom's.
Your friend knows. Who's he?
Mark, from school.
Anyone else?
Raleigh shakes his head reluctantly.
Is there any way you might get caught? Security cameras.
Raleigh shakes his head again and looks up at his dad. There weren't any security cameras. I checked.
Jesus, I can't believe you. Is that supposed to make me feel better?
They don't even know I was there, Raleigh says defensively.
I was really careful. I told Mom I never took anything. I didn't do any harm.
Then what were you doing there? His dad asks.
I don't know. Just looking around, I guess.
Just looking around, I guess, his dad repeats, and it makes Raleigh feel about 6 years old.
What were you looking at? Ladies' underwear?
No, Raleigh shouts, flushing hotly with embarrassment. He's not some kind of a pervert, he mutters.
I was mostly looking in the computers.
Dear God, his dad shouts.
You went into people's computers?
Raleigh nods miserably. His dad slams the table and gets up. He starts pacing around the kitchen, glaring back at Raleigh.
Don't people use passwords?
Sometimes I can get past them, he says, his voice quavering.
And what did you do when you were looking around in people's private computers?
Well, and it all comes out in a rush. He feels his mouth twist as he tries not to cry.
All I did was write some prank emails from someone's email account.
And then, uncharacteristically, he bursts into tears. Chapter 2. Olivia sizes up the situation. Paul is angrier than she's ever seen him. That makes sense. Raleigh has never done anything remotely like this before. She knows a large part of the anger is because of fear. Are they losing control of their 16-year-old son? Why did he do this? He wants for nothing. They've brought Raleigh up to know right from wrong, so what is going on? She watches him, sniffling miserably in his chair, his father staring at him silently as if deciding what to do, what the appropriate punishment should be. What, she asks herself, is the civil, decent thing to do? What will help Raleigh learn from this? What will assuage her own guilt? She wades in carefully. I think Raleigh should go to these people and apologize. Paul turns on her angrily.
What? You want him to apologize?
For a split second, she resents that he has turned his anger on her, but she lets it go.
I don't mean that's all. Obviously, he will have to face consequences for his behavior, very serious consequences. At the very least, he should be grounded if we can't trust him, and we should take his phone away for a while and restrict his internet time to homework only.
Raleigh looks at her alarmed, as if this is far too harsh a penalty. He really doesn't get it, she thinks. He doesn't understand the enormity of what he's done. She feels a chill settle around her heart. How are you supposed to teach kids anything these days with all the bad behavior they see around them? On the news, all the time, from people in positions of authority. No one seems to behave well or have any appreciation for boundaries anymore. That's not how she was brought up. She was taught to say sorry and to make amends.
He can't apologize, Paul says firmly.
Why not? She asks.
He broke into people's houses. He went through their computers. He broke the law. If he apologizes, he opens himself up to criminal charges. Do you want that?
Her heart seizes with fear.
I don't know, she says crossly. Maybe that's what he deserves.
But it's bravado, really. She's terrified at the thought of her son facing criminal charges, and clearly her husband is too. She realizes suddenly that they'll do anything to protect him. Paul says,
I think we'd better talk to a lawyer, just in case.
The next morning, Sunday, Raleigh is sound asleep when his mother comes into his room and shakes him by the shoulder.
You're getting up now, she says.
And he does. He's on his very best behavior. He wants his phone and internet access back.
And he's terrified of going to the lawyer, which his dad is going to make him do. Last night at the dinner table, his father was saying maybe it would be best in the long run if Raleigh were to face charges and take the legal consequences. His dad wouldn't really make him do that. He thinks he was just trying to scare him. It worked. Raleigh's shitting bricks. Once he's dressed and downstairs, his mom tells him, "We're going to get in the car, and you're going to show me the two houses you broke into." He looks back at her, wary. "Why?" "Because I said so," she says. "Where's Dad?" he asks nervously. "He's gone golfing." They get in the car. She hasn't even let him have breakfast first. He sits in the passenger seat beside her, his stomach growling and his heart thumping. Maybe his parents talked after he was in bed and decided he had to apologize after all. "Which way?" she says. His brain freezes. He can feel himself starting to sweat. He's only going to show her a couple of the houses he's broken into to get her off his back. And he certainly won't tell her the truth about where he was last night. He's tense as his mother reverses out of the driveway and drives down Sparrow Street. The trees are bright gold and orange and red, and everything looks like it did when he was little and his parents raked leaves into a big pile on the lawn for him to jump in. At the corner, he directs her to turn left and then left again onto Finch Street, the long residential street next to and parallel to their own. His mom drives slowly along Finch until he points out a house, number 32, a handsome two-story house painted pale gray with blue shutters and a red front door. She pulls over to the curb and parks, staring at the house as if memorizing it. It's a sunny day, and it's warm in the car. Raleigh's heart is pounding harder now, and sweat is forming on his forehead and between his shoulder blades. He's forgotten all about his hunger. Now he just feels sick. "You're sure it was this house?" she asks. He nods, shifts his eyes away from hers. She continues to stare at the house. There's a horrible moment when he thinks she's going to get out of the car, but it passes. She just sits there. He begins to feel conspicuous. What if the people come out of the house? Is that what she's waiting for? "When did you break into this one?" she asks. "I don't know, a while ago," he mumbles. She turns away from him and studies the house some more. "What are we doing here, Mom?" he asks finally. She doesn't answer. She starts the car again, and he feels himself go weak with relief. "Where's the other one?" she asks. He directs her to turn left again at the end of the street, and left again until they are back on their own street. She looks over at him. "Seriously? You broke into our neighbors? We didn't need to take the car, did we?" He doesn't answer. Silently, he points at number 79, a two-story white house with a bay window in the front, black shutters, and a double garage. Again, she pulls over and stares at the house uneasily. "Are you sure it was this house you broke into last night, Raleigh?" He looks at her furtively, wondering what she's getting at. What's special about this house? As if reading his mind, she says, "His wife ran away from him recently." "That's not my fault," Raleigh thinks sulkily, wishing that he'd shown her a different house. His mom starts the car again and pulls out into the street. "Are you sure you didn't take anything, Raleigh? That it was just a prank?" she says, turning to look at him. "Tell me the truth." He can see how worried she is, and he feels awful for making her feel that way. "I swear, Mom, I didn't take anything." At least that's the truth. He feels bad for what he's put his parents through, especially his mom. Yesterday, he promised his parents he would never do it again, and he means it. Olivia drives the short way home in silence, turning things over in her mind. The houses on these familiar streets were built decades ago. They're set far apart and well back from the road, so they are only dimly lit by the streetlights at night. It would be easy to break into them without being seen. She'd never given a thought to that before. Maybe they should get a security system. She recognizes the irony of it. She's thinking of getting a security system because her own son has been breaking into their neighbors' homes. Tomorrow is Monday. Paul will call a law firm he knows and make an appointment for them to see someone about this. If she'd spent a good part of the previous afternoon searching Raleigh's room as he looked on, miserable, she hadn't found anything that shouldn't be there. She and Paul had discussed it again in bed last night. She hardly slept afterward.
Parenting is so stressful, she thinks, glancing sidelong at her moody son slouched in the seat beside her. You try to do your best, but really, what control do you have over them once they're not little anymore? You have no idea what's going on inside their heads or what they're up to. What if she'd never seen that text? How long would it have gone on? Until he was arrested and the cops showed up at the house? He was breaking into places, snooping through people's lives, and they'd know nothing about it. If anyone had accused her son of such a thing, she would never have believed it. That's how little she knows him these days, but she saw those texts herself. He admitted it. She wonders uneasily if he's keeping any other secrets. She parks the car in their driveway and says, Raleigh, is there anything else you want to tell me? He turns to her, startled. What? You heard me. Is there anything else I should know? She looks at him, hesitates, and adds, I don't necessarily have to tell your father. He's obviously surprised at that, but shakes his head. It makes her wonder if she should have said it. She and Paul are supposed to represent a united front. She says, in a neutral voice, which takes real effort, Tell me the truth. Are you doing drugs? He actually smiles. No, Mom, I'm not doing drugs. This is it, I swear. And I won't do it again. You can relax. But she can't relax, because she's his mother, and she worries that his breaking into people's homes, not out of greed, not to steal, but just to look around, might indicate that there's something wrong with him. It isn't normal, is it? And those emails he sent from someone's email account worry her. He wouldn't tell her what they said. She hasn't really pushed it because she's not sure she wants to know. How messed up is he? Should he see someone? Some of the kids she knows are seeing therapists for all kinds of things. Anxiety, depression. When she was growing up, kids didn't see therapists. But it's a different time. When they get inside, she retreats to the office upstairs and closes the door. She knows Paul won't be home from his golf game for hours. She sits at the computer and types up a letter. A letter of apology, which she will not sign. It is not easy to write. When she's satisfied with it, she prints two copies and puts them into two plain white envelopes, seals them, and then goes downstairs and places them in the bottom of her purse. She will have to wait until after dark to deliver them. She will go out late to run an errand at the corner store. Then she'll slip around and deliver the letters. She won't tell Paul and Raleigh what she's done. She already knows they wouldn't approve, but it makes her feel better. After a moment's consideration, she goes back to the computer and deletes the document. Chapter 3. It's early in the morning on Monday, October 16th. The light in the sky has been growing steadily stronger. The air is chilly. Detective Webb stands perfectly still, watching the mist rise off the lake, holding a paper cup of coffee that has long since gone cold. The surface of the lake farther out is perfectly still. He hears a bird cry in the distance. It reminds him of camping as a boy. It would be a peaceful scene if it weren't for the crew of divers and the various vehicles, equipment, and personnel nearby. The area outside of Aylesford is a lovely place for a vacation. He's been out here before with his wife, but it's first thing on a Monday morning, and he's not here to enjoy himself. You still drinking that? Detective Moen asks, looking sideways at him. She's his partner, a head shorter and a decade younger, late 20s to his late 30s, and sharp as a tack. He likes working with her. She has short brown hair and perceptive blue eyes. He looks at her and shakes his head, dumps the cold coffee out on the ground. A local retired man by the name of Brian Roth had been along here in his rowboat at dawn fishing for bass. He thought he saw something beneath his boat, something that looked like a car not far from shore. He called the police. The county sheriff's office regional underwater search and recovery team had come out. They could see there was a car down there. Now they need to find out what else might be under the water. The divers have just gone down to take a look. Webb stands and watches the water, Moen beside him, waiting for the divers to surface. He wants to know if there's a body in the car. Or worse, more than one. Odds are there is. In the meantime, he thinks about the logistics of it. There's a road behind them, a lonely road. A suicide spot, maybe? The car isn't far from shore, but the water in this particular spot gets deep quickly. There's a strip of beach and then the edge of the lake. He turns and looks back again at the road behind him. The road curves here. If someone was driving too fast, or was drunk or high, could the car have missed the curve and gone down the slight incline into the water? There's no guardrail to prevent it. He wonders how long the car's been there. It's an out-of-the-way spot. A car that went into the water here might stay unnoticed for a long time. His attention shifts to the man standing at the edge of the road. The older man waves a nervous hello. Webb and Moen walk over to him. "You the one who spotted it?" Webb asks. The man nods. "Yes, I'm Brian Roth." "I'm Detective Webb, and this is Detective Moen from Aylesford Police," he says, showing the man his badge. "You fish along here regularly?" Webb asks. The man shakes his head. "No, I don't generally come down here. Never fished along this bit before. I was just floating along here," he points out at the water with a finger, "with my line in the water, and I felt it snag. I bent over to have a look and started pulling on it, and I saw a car." "It's good that you called it in," Moen says. The man nods, laughs nervously. "It really freaked me out. You don't expect to see a car under the water." He looks at them uneasily. "Do you think there's someone in it?"
"That's what we're here to find out," Webb says.
He turns away from the man and looks back at the lake. At that moment, a diver breaks through the surface and looks toward the shore. He shakes his head firmly, "No," Webb says.
"There's your answer."
But it's not the answer he was expecting. If there's no body in the car, how did the car get into the water? Who was driving it? Maybe somebody pushed it in. Moen beside him looks just as surprised. Could be all sorts of reasons there's nobody in the car. Maybe whoever was driving managed to get out and didn't report it because they'd been drinking. Maybe the car had been stolen. They'll get it out of the water and get the license plate, and then they'll have somewhere to start. Moen stands beside him, silently going over the possibilities just as he is. "Thanks for your help," Webb says to Roth, and then turns abruptly and walks toward the lake, Moen falling into step beside him. The man stands uncertainly, left behind. The diver is coming up to the shore now. The marine officers stand by. It's their job to get the car out of the water. They've done this countless times. A second diver is still down there getting things ready to lift the vehicle out. The diver lifts up his mask. "It's a four-door sedan. All the windows are wide open." He pauses and adds, "Might have been sunk deliberately." Webb bites his lower lip. "Any idea how long it's been in the water?"
"I'd guess a couple of weeks, give or take."
"Okay, thanks. Let's bring her up," he says. They step back again and let the experts do their work. Webb and Moen stand in silence and watch. Finally, there's a loud swooshing sound and the car breaks through the water. It's raised a few feet above the surface when they see it for the first time. Water streams from the windows and out the cracks in the doors. It hangs there, suspended from cables in the air for a minute, resurrected. The car swings slowly over and onto the shore. It lands on the ground with a bounce and then settles, still leaking fluids. Careful about his shoes, Webb approaches the vehicle. It's a fairly new Toyota Camry, and, just as the diver said, all four windows are open. Webb looks in the front seat and sees a woman's purse peeking out from beneath the seat. He looks into the back seat and sees an overnight case on the floor. The car smells of stagnant lake water and rot. He pulls his head out and walks around to the back of the vehicle. New York plates. He turns to Moen.
"Call it in,"
he says. She gives a curt nod and calls in the plate number while the two of them walk around the vehicle. Finally, they've come full circle and stop at the back of the car again. It's time to open the trunk. Webb has a bad feeling. He turns and looks back at the man who first saw the car in the water. He doesn't come closer. He looks as apprehensive as Webb feels, but the detective knows better than to show it.
"Let's get this open," he directs.
A member of the team approaches with a crowbar. He's obviously done this before. The trunk pops open. They all look inside. There's a woman there. She's lying on her back with her legs folded up to one side, fully clothed in jeans and a sweater. She's white, probably late 20s, long brown hair. Webb notes the wedding ring and the diamond engagement ring on her finger. He can see that she has been savagely beaten. Her skin is pale and waxy, and her one remaining eye is wide open. She looks up at him as if she's asking for help. He can tell that she was beautiful. "Christ," Webb says under his breath. Chapter 4. Carmen Torres rises early Monday morning. Sunlight is beginning to filter through the front windows and into the entryway as she makes her way down the stairs, anticipating her first cup of coffee. She's halfway down when she sees it, a white envelope lying all by itself on the dark hardwood floor just inside the front door. How odd. It wasn't there last night when she went up to bed. Must be junk mail, she thinks, in spite of the no junk mail sign she has displayed outside. But junk mail doesn't usually get delivered late at night. She walks over to the envelope and picks it up. There's nothing written on it. She considers tossing it into the recycle bin without opening it, but she's curious and tears it open casually as she walks into the kitchen. But as soon as her eyes fall on the letter inside, she stops and stands completely still. She reads, "This is a very difficult letter to write. I hope you will not hate us too much. There is no easy way to say this, so I will just spell it out. My son broke into your home recently while you were out. Yours was not the only home he snuck into. I know that's not much comfort. He swears he didn't steal anything. I've searched his room very thoroughly, and I'm pretty sure he's telling the truth about that. He says he just looked around. He was very careful and didn't break or damage anything. You probably don't even know he was there. But I feel I have to let you know that he snooped in your computer. He's very good with computers. And admits that he wrote some prank emails from someone's account. He wouldn't tell me the content of those emails. I think he is too embarrassed. But I feel that you should know. I would hate for them to cause you any trouble. I am mortified by his behavior. I'm sorry that he can't apologize to you in person. I can't tell you my name or his name because his father is worried that it will leave our son open to criminal charges. But please believe me when I tell you that we are all deeply sorry and ashamed of his behavior. Teenage boys can be a handful. Please accept this apology, and I assure you that it will never happen again. My son has faced serious consequences for his actions at home. I just wanted you to know that it happened and that we are deeply sorry." Carmen lifts her eyes from the page, appalled. Someone broke into her house? What an introduction to the neighborhood. She's only lived here for a couple of months. She's still getting used to the place, trying to make friends. She's not happy about the letter. It makes her feel unsettled. It's awful to think that someone was inside her house, creeping around, going through her things, getting into her computer without her even knowing. She'll look around and make sure nothing's missing. She's not going to take this woman's word for it. And she'd better check her computer for any sent emails that she didn't write herself. The more she thinks about it, the more upset she gets. She feels invaded. Carmen wanders into the kitchen and starts making coffee. As upset as she can't help feeling sorry for the woman who wrote the letter. How awful for her, she thinks. But she'd love to know who it was. Robert Pierce stops at the bottom of his stairs, staring at the plain white envelope on the floor in his front hall. Someone must have pushed it through the slot while he was upstairs in bed last night. He steps forward slowly, his bare feet making no sound on the hardwood floor. He reaches down and picks up the envelope, turning it over. There's nothing written on it at all. He opens the envelope and pulls out the single sheet of paper, then reads the letter in disbelief. It's unsigned. Reaching the end of it, he looks up, seeing nothing. Someone has been inside his house. Sinking down onto the bottom stair, he reads the letter again. Some teenager, messing about. He can't believe it. He sits for a long time, thinking he might have a problem. Raleigh goes to school on Monday morning, relieved to get out of the house. He's also feeling completely disconnected. He hasn't been online all weekend. He feels almost blind without his cell phone.
He has no way to reach anyone, to make plans, to know what's going on. He feels like a bat without radar, or sonar, or whatever. He has to hope he runs into Mark in the hall or in the cafeteria because they don't have any classes together today. But then he finds Mark waiting for him by his locker. Of course, Mark will have figured it out. "Parents take your phone?" Mark asks as Raleigh opens his locker. "Yeah." His anger at his friend's stupidity has subsided as he recalled that he'd probably sent equally stupid texts to him. Plus, he needs a friend right now.
"Why? What'd you do?"
Raleigh leans in closer. "Those texts you sent? My mom saw them. They know." Mark looks alarmed.
"Shit! Sorry!"
Raleigh is very sorry now that he ever, in a moment of bravado, told Mark what he was doing. He'd been showing off, but now he wishes he'd kept his mouth shut. Raleigh glances over his shoulder to see if anyone can hear them. He lowers his voice. "Now they're taking me to see a lawyer to decide what to do. My own parents are considering turning me in."
"No way. They wouldn't do that. They're your parents."
"Yeah, well, they're pretty pissed." Raleigh shrugs off his backpack.
"See you after school?"
Mark asks, obviously worried.
"Sure, meet me here after last class."
He grabs his books.
"I fucking hate not having a phone."
Olivia has work to do, but she can't focus. She works from home as a copy editor of educational textbooks. She has enough work to keep her moderately busy, but not overly so, so that she can manage the house and family. It's a satisfactory but not particularly fulfilling arrangement. Sometimes she daydreams about doing something completely different. Maybe she'll become a real estate agent or work in a gardening shop. She has no idea, but the thought of change is appealing. Olivia had been too distracted to work, waiting for Paul to call her about when they're meeting the lawyer. And now that she's learned that it will be today, she can't think about anything else. She hesitates, but then picks up her phone and calls Glenda Newell. Glenda picks up on the second ring. She works from home, too, putting together fancy gift baskets for a local business a few hours a week. She's usually up for coffee if Olivia calls.
"Do you want to meet at the Bean for coffee?"
Olivia asks. She can hear the tension in her own voice, although she's trying to keep it light.
"I could use a talk."
"Sure, I'd love to," Glenda says. "Everything all right?" Olivia hasn't decided how much she's going to tell Glenda.
"Yep, 15 minutes.
"Perfect." When Olivia arrives at the local coffee shop, Glenda is already there. The Bean is a comfortable place, with an old-fashioned coffee bar and mismatched tables and chairs, and walls covered in funky thrift shop art. Not a chain, and very popular with the locals, in an area where many people seem to work from home. Glenda has found a table at the back where they can have some privacy. Olivia orders a decaf Americano at the counter and joins Glenda at the table.
"What's up?" Glenda asks. "You don't look that great."
"I haven't been sleeping well the last couple of nights," Olivia admits, looking at Glenda. She really needs to confide in someone. She and Glenda have been close for 16 years. They met in a mom's group when Raleigh and Glenda's son Adam were infants. Their husbands have become fast friends as well. They socialize together frequently. It was Glenda and her husband Keith who had been over for dinner on Friday night when Raleigh was out getting into trouble. She can tell Glenda. Glenda will understand. Mothers can be awfully competitive these days, but she and Glenda have never been that way. They've always been honest and supportive with each other about the kids. Olivia knows that Adam has had his problems. Twice now, at 16, he's come home so drunk that he's spent the night hovering over the toilet or collapsed on the bathroom floor. Glenda has had to stay awake watching over him to make sure he didn't choke on his own vomit. Parenting is hard. Olivia doesn't know what she'd do without Glenda to help her through it, and she knows Glenda is grateful for her, too. "You're not going to believe this," Olivia says, leaning forward and speaking quietly.
"What?"
Glenda asks. Olivia glances around to make sure they can't be overheard and says, lowering her voice even further, "Raleigh's been breaking into people's houses." The shock on Glenda's face says it all. Suddenly, tears are brimming in Olivia's eyes, and she's afraid she's going to have a full-blown meltdown right there in the coffee shop.
Glenda leans in and puts a comforting hand on her shoulder while Olivia scrabbles for a paper napkin and holds it to her eyes. The girl picks that moment to bring Olivia's coffee over, sets it down, and moves swiftly away, pretending not to notice that Olivia is crying. "Oh, Olivia," Glenda says, her face shifting from shock to sympathy. "What happened? Did he get caught by the police?" Olivia shakes her head and tries to recover her composure. "It was Friday night when you guys were over for dinner." She'd thought about asking Raleigh to stay home for the dinner party. He'd already made plans with a friend to go see a movie, or so he'd said. She could have insisted he stay home. He and Adam used to be friends, but had drifted apart that spring when Adam started drinking. But part of her didn't really want Raleigh around Adam. She was afraid he would be a bad influence. She didn't want Raleigh to start drinking. Of course, she couldn't tell Glenda that. Instead, she'd told Glenda that Raleigh had already made plans and Glenda had been fine with it. Adam found something else to do. And now it turns out that her own son had found something else to do, too. Olivia tells Glenda the whole mortifying story, except for the part about the apology letters. She keeps that to herself. "Why would Raleigh do something like that?" Glenda asks in genuine bewilderment. "He's always been such a good kid." "I don't know," Olivia admits. "It seems..." She can't continue. She doesn't want to put it into words, to make her concerns real. "It seems what?" "Odd. Why would he want to snoop around people's houses like that? It's abnormal. Is he some kind of voyeur? Do you think I should get him some help?" Glenda sits back and bites her lip. "I don't think you should get carried away here. He's a teenager. They're stupid. They don't think. They do whatever seems like a good idea at any given moment. Kids do this kind of thing all the time." "Do they?" Olivia asks anxiously. "But don't they usually steal something? He didn't take anything." "Are you sure? Maybe all he took was a bottle of booze, or maybe he drank some alcohol out of a bottle and then topped it up with water. Kids do that shit. Believe me, I know." Her face goes grim. "Maybe," Olivia says, thinking about it. Maybe that was all it was. She hadn't checked Raleigh's breath when he was sleeping. She hadn't known anything was wrong until the next day. Maybe she should keep an eye on their liquor cabinet at home. "Anyway," she says, "we're seeing a lawyer this afternoon. We'll see what he says. We're mostly doing it to scare him." Glenda nods. "Probably not a bad idea." They sip their coffees. Then Glenda changes the subject. "Are you still going to book club tonight?" she asks. "Yes, I need to get out," Olivia says, looking glum. "Don't tell anybody about this, okay? It's strictly between us." "Of course," Glenda says. "And honestly, it's great that you caught it early. Nip it in the bud now. Get the lawyer to scare him shitless. As long as he never does it again, you're good. No harm done." Glenda Newell makes her way back home from the Bean, her mind on what Olivia has just told her. Poor Olivia. Raleigh breaking into houses. Still, it's a comfort that other families have their problems, too. It does make her feel just a little bit better about her own situation. She herself is worried sick about Adam. His impulsiveness, his inability to regulate his behavior. She can hardly sleep at night for worrying about her son. And she's worried that he has the addictive gene. He's taken to drinking with a shocking enthusiasm. What's next? The thought of all the drugs out there makes her panic. God only knows what the next few years will bring. The last one has been harrowing enough. Sometimes she doesn't know if she will survive it. Keith seems to have his head buried in the sand these days. Either he doesn't want to face things, or he genuinely sees nothing wrong with binge drinking at 16. But then Keith isn't a worrier. So handsome, with his bluff self-confidence and easy charm, he always thinks things will turn out just fine. He tells her that she worries too much. Maybe he's right. But she's a mother. It's her job to worry. Chapter 5. Robert Pierce is leaving for work when he opens the door and sees a tall, dark-haired man in his late 30s and a shorter, mousy-haired woman about 10 years younger. Both are well-dressed. His first thought is that they're soliciting for something. Then the man holds up his badge and says,
"Good morning, Robert Pierce."
"Yes."
"I'm Detective Webb, and this is Detective Moen from Aylesford Police. We're here to talk to you about your wife."
He's never seen these two before. Why are they here now? He hears his heart suddenly drumming in his ears.
"Have you found her?" he asks.
The words come out sounding choked.
"May we come in, Mr. Pierce?"
He nods and steps back, opening the door wide, and then closes it firmly behind them. Robert leads them into the living room.
"Maybe we should sit down,"
Detective Webb suggests, when Robert stands uncertainly in the middle of the living room, staring at them. All at once, Robert finds he needs to sit. He collapses into an armchair. He can feel the blood draining from his head. He stares at the detectives, slightly dizzy. The moment has come. The detectives sit on the sofa, their back straight, the bay window behind them.
"We found your wife's car this morning."
"Her car?" Robert manages to say.
"Where?" "It was in a lake out near Canning."
"What do you mean, in a lake? Was she in an accident?" He looks back and forth between them, his mouth dry.
"It was submerged just offshore in about 15 feet of water. Her purse and an overnight bag were in the car."
He adds quietly,
"A body was found in the trunk."
Robert slumps back against his chair as if he's had the breath knocked out of him. He can feel the two detectives watching him carefully. He looks back at them, afraid to ask,
"Is it her?" "We think so."
Robert feels himself go pale. He can't speak. Detective Webb leans forward and Robert notices his eyes for the first time. Sharp, intelligent eyes.
"I know this is a shock, but we need you to come down to identify the body."
Robert nods. He gets up, grabs a jacket, and follows them outside to the street and gets into the back of their car. The county medical examiner's office is a new, low brick building. Robert gets out of the car, expecting to be led into a morgue. He imagines a long, cold, sterile room with shiny, pale tiles and stainless steel and harsh light and the smell of death. His head begins to spin, and he knows they are watching him. But instead of a morgue, they conduct him to a large, modern waiting room with a glass viewing panel. He stands in front of the glass and watches as the sheet is turned down to reveal the face of the body on the steel gurney.
"Is that your wife?"
Webb asks. He forces himself to look.
"Yes,"
he says, then closes his eyes.
"I'm sorry," the detective says. "Let's get you home."
Silently, they return to the car. Robert gazes out the window, but he doesn't see the passing streets. What he sees is his wife's face, battered, bloated, and tinged with green. He knows what's going to happen next. They are going to question him. They arrive at his house. The two detectives get out of the car and accompany him to the door. Detective Webb says,
"I'm sorry, I know this is a difficult time, but we'd like to come in and ask you a few more questions, if that's all right with you."
Robert nods and lets them in. They return to the living room they'd been in just a short time before, take the same seats. He swallows and says,
"I don't know anything more than I did when she disappeared a couple of weeks ago. I told the police everything I could then.
What have you been doing all this time?" It comes out more confrontationally than it should have. Detective Webb looks back at him without blinking.
"You weren't even looking for her," Robert says. His voice is bitter.
"That's the impression I got, anyway."
"It's a murder investigation now," the detective says, glancing at his partner. "Obviously, there will be an autopsy and we'll be looking at everything very closely." He adds, "We need to go back to the beginning."
Robert nods wearily.
"Fine. How long were you and your wife married, Mr. Pierce?"
"2 years last June." He notices that the other detective, Moen, is taking notes.
"Were there any problems in your marriage?"
"No, nothing out of the ordinary."
"Had your wife ever been unfaithful to you?"
"No."
Had you ever been unfaithful to her?
No.
Any arguments, any violence or abuse?
He bristles.
Of course not.
Did your wife have any enemies?
No, not at all.
Anything different about her in the days or even weeks before she went missing? Did she seem preoccupied at all? Did she mention anyone bothering her?
He shakes his head. No, not that I noticed. Everything was fine.
Any financial problems?
He shakes his head.
No. We were planning a trip to Europe. Work was good for me. She was a temp, and she liked that. The freedom. Didn't like being tied down to the same job 52 weeks a year.
Tell us about that weekend, the detective says. Robert looks at both detectives and says,
she'd planned to go away that weekend with a friend of hers, Caroline Liu. They were going into New York City.
He pauses. That's what she told me, anyway.
Did she do this kind of thing often? Go away for the weekend?
Sometimes. She liked her little shopping expeditions.
How would she make her travel arrangements?
He lifts his head.
She made her own arrangements. She booked things online, on her laptop, put it on her credit card.
You weren't suspicious when she left?
No, not at all. I knew Caroline. I liked her. They've done this sort of thing before, he adds. I don't enjoy shopping.
So tell us about Friday morning, Webb says.
September 29th.
She'd packed her overnight case the night before. I remember she was humming as she went around the bedroom packing her things. I was lying on the bed watching her. She seemed happy. He looks earnestly at the two detectives.
We made love that night.
Everything was fine, he assures them. But it wasn't like that, he remembers. Not at all.
The next morning, Robert continues, when she was leaving for work, I kissed her goodbye, told her to have fun. She was going to leave directly from work, leave her car at the station, and take the train in. It was her last day of that temp assignment.
Where was that? The detective asks.
I told the police all this already, Robert complains. It was an accounting firm. The information must be in the file.
He feels a flash of irritation.
Did you talk to her again that day at all?
No. I meant to, but I was busy with work. When I got home, I called her cell, but she didn't answer. I didn't think anything of it at the time, but she didn't pick up all weekend. It just went to voicemail. We're not a clingy couple, calling each other all the time. I thought she was busy having fun. I didn't think much of it.
When did you start to realize something was wrong? Webb asks.
When she didn't return Sunday night, as expected, I started to worry. I'd left messages on her cell, but she hadn't called me back. I couldn't remember where they were staying, either. That's when I called Caroline. I thought her husband might know something, if they'd been delayed. But Caroline answered the phone.
He pauses.
And she told me that she'd never had plans with Amanda that weekend. That she hadn't actually talked to Amanda in a while.
He rubs a hand over his face.
I went to the police station on Monday morning and reported her missing.
What kind of work do you do?
Detective Moen asks. It startles him a bit, and he turns his attention to her.
I'm an attorney, he adds. I should call the office.
The detective ignores that.
Can you confirm for us where you were that weekend, from Friday the 29th of September to Monday? She asks.
What?
Can you confirm?
Yes, sure. He says, I was at work all day Friday, left about 5. I went directly home. I told the police all of this before when I reported her missing. I stayed in on Friday night. On Saturday, I was home, caught up on some work. Sunday, I went golfing with some friends. He adds,
it must all be in the file.
Did your wife have any family besides you? Detective Moen asks.
No, she was an only child and her parents are both dead.
He pauses.
Maybe I can ask a question.
Sure,
Detective Webb says. Do you have any idea what might have happened? Who might have done this?
Not yet, the detective says. But we won't stop until we find out.
Is there anything else that you can tell us?
Not that I can think of, Robert says, his face a careful blank.
Okay,
Webb says. He adds, as if it's an afterthought, we'd like to have a team come in and take a look inside your house, if that's all right with you.
Robert says, his voice sharp,
You ignore my concerns for 2 weeks, and now you want to search my house? You can get a warrant.
Fine. We'll do that, Webb says.
Robert stands up, and the two detectives get up and leave. Once he's watched them drive away, Robert locks the front door and quickly makes his way upstairs to his office. He sits in the chair at the desk and pulls open the bottom drawer. There's a stack of manila envelopes inside. He knows that beneath those envelopes is his wife's burner phone, the one the cops don't know about. He sits for a moment, staring at the envelopes, afraid. He thinks about the letter he got that morning, downstairs in a kitchen drawer. Somebody was in his house. Some teenager was here, snooping through his desk, and he must have seen the phone. Because one day, when Robert had opened the drawer, the phone had been sitting right on top of those manila envelopes. The shock of it had made him start in his chair. He knew he'd put the phone beneath the envelopes. But now he knows. That kid must have seen the phone, moved it, and now the police are going to search his house. He has to get rid of it. He has a small window of time before they come back with a warrant, but how much time? He reaches beneath the envelopes for the cell phone, suddenly afraid that it won't be there at all. But he can feel its smooth surface in his hand, and he pulls it out. He stares down at it, this phone that has caused him such pain. He closes the drawer and shoves the phone in his pocket. He looks out the window. The street below is empty. When the news breaks that his wife's body has been found, there will be reporters on his doorstep. He'll never be able to get away then. He must act quickly. He changes into jeans and a t-shirt, hurries downstairs, grabs a jacket and his keys by the front door, and stops suddenly, just short of opening the door. What if someone sees him? And later the detectives find out that he rushed out of the house right after they left. He stands still for a minute, thinking. They'll search the house. He can't hide the phone in the house. What options does he have? He walks to the back and looks out the door from the kitchen to the backyard. It's a very private yard. Maybe he can bury the phone in the back flower garden. Surely they won't dig up the garden. They already have the body. He spies Amanda's gardening set on the patio, puts on her gardening gloves, and grabs a trowel. He walks to the flower beds at the back of the garden. He looks around. The only house that can see into his yard is Becky's, and he doesn't see her, watching at the windows or from the back door. He bends down and quickly digs a small, narrow hole, about 10 inches deep, underneath a shrub.